Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another edition of the Daily Friend Show. I am your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm joined today by Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you?
But tell you today, but otherwise fine.
Good, good. And of course, Mr. Gabriel Krauser, who's dressed for the weather.
Yes, I've been walking around outside, and it's gloriously sunny, but crisp, which is good.
So I just wanted to say something about that. Yesterday, of course, we had ominous dark clouds over Joburg, at least when we were recording. And I thought it was very fitting for the sort of situation the country found itself in. But I guess the question of today is, it may be clear blue skies over Joburg, but is it still ominous clouds over Nkandla in KZN? Mm. So, of course, today is the deadline by which the police have to arrest Jacob Zuma, as per the original contempt of court ruling. Zuma had until Sunday to present himself to the constitutional court, to the police for arrest. And failing that, he had to be arrested or apprehended by midnight tonight. So we are in a bit of a constitutional crisis of a sort if he doesn't get arrested. As Gabriel put it before the show, we really are asking the question today, are we being run by a criminal enterprise? Gabriel, can you unpack this for us a bit? What do you think is going to happen? Things may even develop between now and when this episode airs, which will be in like 1 or 2 hours from now. What are your thoughts on how this is all going to go down and what's important and all that sort of thing?
So I think most listeners will already be familiar with the background. Zuma gets convicted for contempt of court. And as Nicholas said, he has to be arrested since he hasn't showed up. In between that, the police wrote a letter and made a statement yesterday through a secretariat to say that they won't be arresting Zuma because he's appealed to the High Court to stay or pause his arrest until the rescission application to the Constitutional Court is heard. So it looked like the police were going to try and dodge out of this. I think they had only listened to Dali and Porfu's arguments at the time, the representative of Jacob Zuma, his counsel. And he made a very strong case, a very passionate case, I should say. I watched a lot of it. It was very passionate.
Yeah, there's a very important distinction between those two things.
On the other hand, arguments coming from the counsel for the commission, the Zondo Commission, and for the Helen Suzman Foundation, I think showed unambiguously that there is no confusion here. The highest apex court in the country has made an order. That order must be upheld. And so today, Becky Cele has, through the police ministry spokesperson, said, unless we hear from the Constitutional Court otherwise, we have no choice but to conduct that arrest. Subsequently, we've seen reports coming from the ANC's National Executive Council where members, high up members of the ANC, have begged Becky Cele to go to Jacob Zuma to beg him to get out of Nkandla so that the arrest can be conducted in a way that doesn't result in some kind of Marikana-esque bloodshed. So that's why he is reportedly in KZN. He's making his way to Getli Hlekisa to ask him nicely to avoid a bullet sort of standoff. The question is, of course, what will happen and what does it mean? So if what happens is that Becky Cele manages to get a quiet arrest, we will have the best outcome, both in the immediate sense that people aren't killed and in the broader sense that the Constitutional Court's order will have been maintained. The High Court of Pietermaritzburg will still have a chance on Friday to rule on the application that Zuma made. And they could then say, look, we think we have jurisdiction. We think that it's reasonable to suspend his arrest until the Constitutional Court next week hears his rescission application. And so he will get released. So he will have been in jail for 2 days. That would be extravagant, I think is the right word, an extravagant judgment from the High Court. One thing that no media commentator I've noticed has said yet is that the Constitutional Court in its order says what we are doing here is taking jurisdiction outside of the aegis of any other court. So if you go and find the judgment in Control F jurisdiction, you will find very strong wording from the Constitutional Court to say, we have the jurisdiction in this matter. I think that on top of a mountain of jurisprudence that we can get into in another show perhaps, gives my reason for thinking that the Pietermaritzburg High Court is just going to say, look, you've come to the wrong place. I can't find one way or another. But so there's the quietly situation. What would that mean in terms of broader South African politics? I think it would send the clearest signal yet that not Ramaphosa, who has been sort of quietly nowhere on this, not whoever your favorite puppet master is, but in fact, those people holding unelected high office, sworn to serve the country and the Constitution, have some powers and are willing to exercise those powers in order to get what's done, what needs to be done, done. And I think that would send a shiver up the spine of some people, and I think you might see a real clash within the ANC as people get a little bit more afraid of consequences coming to bear. You might see some people starting to get ready to actually come forward and bear witness against one another with real hard evidence. The second option is that no such quiet arrest is made, and instead there is a bullets standoff. I think that if that happens, South African politics will accelerate. The trajectory that we're on is for the ANC to split and demise. If there is an Nkandla Marikana kind of situation, I think that will accelerate that process because militants around the country will try and get up and toy, and it'll be more bloodshed, and it'll be very ugly, and it'll rip the credibility from the ruling tripartite alliance and its EFF minority partner. The third option is perhaps still the most, well, I thought it was the most likely until I saw Becky Kelly's comment that we have no choice but to make this arrest, and that's the option where nothing is done on the basis that we don't know how to do it. Or rather on the basis that there's no way to do it safely. And I think if that happens, it will send a very clear message that we're run by a criminal syndicate, that you have a police minister who doesn't follow the orders of the Constitutional Court, even after the police minister has said he has to follow the orders of the Constitutional Court. So in his own mind, he's now said he's clear on what he has to do. If he doesn't do it, I think it'll send the message in a very straightforward way. And to some people who think that we've heard this all before and there's been so much evidence already of state capture and corruption and potholes and no electricity and all the kinds of problems that we all know very much about, they might think, what's really new about this? I think what's new about this is that in every language and every culture, people understand what it is a deadline, what it is Wednesday night, what it is go to jail. Those are basic, simple, black and white kind of issues that have nothing to do with the boring racial politics that often absorbs everything, nothing to do with highfalutin intellectual ideas. It's just so bald and naked, the facts. And the fact is Zuma has to go to jail, or South Africa is a lawless country being run by a criminal syndicate with no interest for anything excepting keeping its own cadres in the pocket. In the pleasure pocket.
I agree with you completely, Gabriel. I think this really is the great test. I think it is something new. It's not just sort of roll our eyes. I agree with your last point there precisely. It's more of the same. This is
the cusp of history.
Yeah.
Today is a watershed day in South African history, one way or another. We don't know which way it's going to go, but whichever way it does will have repercussions for years.
So I think... let me get to you now, Terence. I think, we've had this problem where the country has been run with constant fudges. Everything has been fudged. We'll wait for the next deadline. Zuma's entire sort of Stalingrad legal strategy was based on this, right? We just wait for the next deadline. We fudge this. We don't do this correctly. We fire our lawyers. And the government and the ANC has been very happy to play along with that because it can sort of keep the status quo going forever, right? We just fudge, fudge, fudge. And I think there's definitely a temptation to try and do that here. But what I like is that it seems to me that the Constitutional Court and the judiciary, at least some of it, and Judge Zondo have really realized that we're heading for a situation where they are effectively irrelevant and that they needed to force some sort of resolution. So it looks like they've flexed their muscles here, and they've kind of force the ANC to actually commit to not just rely on fudges anymore. What are your thoughts, Terence, on that theory? And what are your thoughts on how this is going to shake out? Do you agree with Gabriel's scenarios there?
Look, I think that this is the moment that the ANC prayed was never going to come, when you actually do have a hard and fast yes or no binary answer. You know, the court judgment was quite explicit. Go to prison. Go directly to Westville. Do not pass the union buildings in Kantla or in Tudy House. Do not collect your brown envelope, your 200 Rand, or your 2 billion retirement, which is apparently what at one stage Zuma was offered, to go quietly. Now we are stuck in our bolt hole in Kantla. You can't fudge that choice anymore. Zuma will be arrested for doing what he has done, which the facts seem pretty much uncontested. He has taken this has been taken all the way up to the highest court in the land, or he will get away with it. And we will be saying, yes, certain people are above the law. I think that it's very distressing that that Zuma's acolytes have discovered the sort of Achilles heel. Enough people sort of stand and threaten a confrontation. I think there is a lot of sensitivity about opening fire. So yes, you make other people complicit in undermining the rule of law. But you know, by any sort of reasonable interpretation of these events, you talked about the Stalingrad strategy. This is now what I would say is the von Paulus moment, 2nd of February 1943, where you sort of march out in your columns, you know, having fired your last shot and whatever, and you march off into captivity. You can't keep on, doing this forever. I think that maybe he got the analogies mixed up, that he was the Russians, but you know, he was actually the Germans. The space became progressively smaller and smaller and smaller. We may be surprised, you know, perhaps black helicopters will sort of land a SWAT team in to sort of escort him away while the main body waits outside. I don't think so. But yes, one way or another, tomorrow we will know whether certain people are beyond the law. People have asked me about this. I've said, I can't give you any reason why he should not rationally, but I can't in my mind's eye see it happening. Now, I don't know. Make of that what you will. But there is something about this conjunction of events that just that says what is rational is not going to happen. What is rational, what is clear, what is legal. I think, unfortunately, a lot of those things have been, as you say, fudged, but in fudging over time have been undermined. Remember when President al-Bashir was spirited out of the country? I think it was Gwede Mantashe who said, yes, what you must understand is that from time to time, court orders will be ignored. Well, I think now you're kind of seeing the fruit of that.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. So, Gabriel, just before we move on, I want your take on, my dad and I were just kind of spitballing about this earlier, and we were talking about a way to try and fudge the arrest. So hypothetically, picture this scenario. Becky Kwele arrives with no police escort. It's just him and a limo and Kandla. And he says, Ubaba, please come with me to the jail. We're going to take you in this limo. We're going to put you in a nice house while you're there. You know, it's all going to be like not really a difficult prison. It's all just play, but just come with me to jail. And then Zuma calls his bluff and says, I'm not going anywhere. What do you think of that idea, that scenario?
I think that's what's happening right now. And I think that it's prudent. I don't see anything substantial enough to be gained from the video footage of Jacob Zuma being pushed into the ground and smothered and handcuffed and then thrown into the back of a van to outweigh the potential cost in life of what that would require to pull off. I think that a quiet arrest is the most seriously good faith way to try and go about this thing. I think your question there is if the bluff gets called, Bekele then goes back and retreats what comes next? You know, Waco comes to mind. I think that there are better and worse ways to try and do this. I think that one thing to consider in terms of time and logistics is if there really are a significant number of armed people in and around Nkandla that show willingness to use force, right? They've police vans come by and they start shooting at those vans. One thing that the police can then do is surround the place and hold it hostage and basically say, we can keep resupplying ourselves. We're going to keep getting food and water and drink. Yeah. And you guys can drink out of the swimming pool and out of Zuma's no doubt well-replete bar for as long as it lasts. But then when you start tiring out of this, you can quietly come filtering back through. And we won't arrest anyone excepting for the leaders. And some leaders must then be arrested in that case. And you basically have a siege. This is the scenario that I conceived of with my old friend Rian Milan back in 2015 when we first contemplated this kind of thing. And I think that a siege would be it's so far also something I don't see discussed out loud. You know, most people think it's either you go in guns blazing or you run away with your tail between your legs. Absolutely not. This kind of thing has happened before in various countries. And sieges can be well pulled off and generally can be very good ways of, because they don't have a supply chain. There's no ways for them to resupply. And so you starve them out.
Yeah. I think it may have been one of the first podcasts we ever did, Gabriel, but I think we once joked about how all this ends with CNN helicopters flying overhead and SANDF attacking in Kandla at a pitched battle and it turns into.
Was a great episode.
Yes, that was back in 2019. So it seems as if we may be blessed with the power of prophecy. Anyway, this is, of course, very interesting, very important. And we will probably talk about it tomorrow, depending on what happens today. But anyway, let us move on very swiftly. Terence, you wanted to talk about one of the great attacks on our civil liberties at the moment. You've been doing some work on it. Of course, we've talked about it before on the show, and that is the threat to our usage of guns, our right to own guns in South Africa. What's going on at the moment?
Well, it's just been interesting for me over the last couple of weeks to see the breadth of public interest in this. And also, I think, upon closer inspection of the legislation and what it portends, This is something that should concern you whether or not you are a gun owner. Why do I say this? What you have here is an amendment, which is something like 140 pages long. It's an enormous document, which changes pretty much everything about the existing act, including the preamble. This is not a tightening up gun regulation. This is essentially introducing a completely new piece of legislation, but calling it an amendment. Now, this in itself, I think, while technically probably not prohibited, I think is very, very bad form. If indeed you want to scrap an overhaul, then start from the beginning and do it properly. The changes that it introduces, we've seen a great deal of commentary about the removal of self-defense as a grounds to own a firearm. But what a lot of people are also missing out on is what it does for things like firearm collecting, which it prohibits outright. And this is a particularly interesting case to my mind, because firearms are recognized under the Heritage Resources Act as a part of our heritage. And worldwide, it's estimated about 80% of historically valuable firearms are held by private collectors. In South Africa, it's estimated that people who have tier that sort of dedicated collector status, only about 2,000 across the country, probably cumulatively own in their firearms assets worth between 750 and a billion rand. This is very significant, and many of these pieces are simply not replaceable. You know, how do you replace General Louis Botha's Mauser from the Boer War, or Martini Henry that was used at San Juana. The act also tries to introduce controls on muzzle loaders. The only way you can really understand this is a sort of vindictiveness. I genuinely cannot think of anyone, no matter how mentally disturbed or crazy or what a history aficionado you are, taking a brown Bess and walking into your local bank branch and saying, stick them up. What are you going to do when the SWAT team arrives? Just give me a minute to reload. I mean, seriously.
Yeah, no, exactly. Is someone going in with an arquebus to rob a bank or something? It's not really.
If you're prepared to do that, surely you can, you know, become a street artist or something. You definitely got.
It'd be better to use a knife in that circumstance.
Then sports shooting. Dedicated sports shooters. The tools they trade are firearms. Now, you don't just take one football to a football match, because if that gets popped, you need another one. It's exactly the same thing with firearms. Now, and if you are a dedicated sports shooter, you are permitted to own more than the average person, because, as I said, this is a sporting activity. The new amendments would cut that down to 6, of which no more than 2 may be handguns. Now, somebody who participates in competitive handgun shooting can require, you know, an arsenal of 8, 10, 12 guns quite legitimately, you know, in case there's a barrel burst or there's an issue with a firing pin or whatever, different ergonomics. No one, not even sports shooters themselves, say that this should be open to everyone. But there are certainly people who have a legitimate sporting need. Shooting has been an Olympic sport since the 1890s. In fact, two Olympics have not featured sport shooting events. It also wants to prohibit anyone under the age of 16 from handling a firearm. So, you know, your 9-year-old who goes to grandpa's farm and, you know, gets to fire the double barrel shotgun or whatever, you know, that's how a lot of kids learn to shoot. And I've spoken to a lot of people from all sorts of backgrounds who can talk about this. Under the amendments, this will be illegal, because you will have to be 16 or over before you may shoot under someone else's supervision. All of these things together tell me that this is not about responding to a rational need. And if you look at the documents, it's clear. I mean, the socioeconomic impact assessment is an insult. The act aims to prohibit collecting, but the word collecting or collector or collections is not used once in that socioeconomic impact assessment. Neither is the word sport, and hunter, I think, is used a couple of times in reference to a court case. But there's no actual discussion of, you know, what the consequences of this will be. The police withheld documents that have been supposedly used to craft this legislation, and it turns out that the independent assessment done by the Witt School of Governance actually refutes it all. It says that the Firearms Control Act has not had much of an effect on crime, because crime is driven by many other factors, one of which I think quite reasonably is the accessibility of firearms. But, you know, that is precisely what you want to try and deal with in a lawful, reasonable way that recognizes different people's rights. The change in the preamble takes it from talking about the right to life, which I think speaks both to the ownership of firearms and to their prudent use and, you know, punishment for mishandling. Changes that to talking about the stability of the state. You know, the change in register is sinister. You know, what I say is, you know, for those who are, you know, let's say anti-gun, you know, for whatever reason, you may not like firearms, you may think you're better off without them. Be very, very careful of backing this piece of legislation, because it has not made its case. It is not based on evidence. And it is, I think, an affront to the principle that the government should actually respect its citizens. If they want to introduce a bill saying, well, we're summarily banning all guns, or, you know, we're banning, you know, most guns, and we're going to come and confiscate, then, you know, they need to make that justification, not trying to bolt it onto all sorts of other things and call it something else. Okay. And it has been interesting. People that I've spoken to who I would never have pitched for firearm supporters who get this. So, you know, today it's firearms, tomorrow your cars perhaps. What about those other sporting codes that have some sort of danger? Boxing, martial arts, archery, stick fighting. And no, you know, we no. can you know, and I think what we're seeing here, and this is without delving in any conspiracy theories, the COVID pandemic has, I think, encouraged some of the worst controlling instincts of governments around the globe. Mm-hmm. And this is seen as a once in a generation opportunity to push a lot of things forward in the hopes that resistance will be too disorganized to make a difference. And I'm glad to see that in terms of firearms, at least this has been miscalculated.
Yeah, no, I think that's right, exactly. Gabriel, if with your permission, can we move on to our next topic today? Unless you have something to add to this,
I think it would be crazy not to draw out the irony here and just mention it, which is that we started out talking about a potential shoot-off between armed protectors of the president and the police, and then segued into talking about guns and private arms. And I think it's important to note that if the amendment had already been passed, that would hardly change the equation at all.
Yeah,
there would still be guns around in Canada, and there'd still be police worried about getting shot and worried about shooting civilians. Thank you.
Okay, yeah, what's see, Gabriel, this is why you're the brains of the operation. Very good. So we don't have much time to cover it, but there has been a big development in the United Kingdom, which seems to be blazing the trail, at least for the sort of democratic world, in how it's going to deal with lockdowns and COVID in the future. And that is, as of, I believe, the 19th of July, they're going to remove pretty much all COVID restrictions, especially for those who are vaccinated in the UK. Gabriel, your thoughts?
Yeah, so we say this a lot on Two Crickets and a Thorn Tree. Can't say it enough. There have always been two arguments for why to vaccinate, why to socially distance, why to do anything. And one is a social argument. It's good for everyone else. You vaccinate to save the world. The other argument is that it's selfish. You vaccinate to save your own life. Now, the sort of clinical virology is just clear as day, that the best reason to get vaccinated is to save your own life. The best reason to socially distance, if you want to do that, is to save your own life. The social effects are less and less, predictably, because of the virus's ability to mutate. This is not Delta, this is not Gamma, this is not Beta. This is what anyone would have thought if they thought that this was a coronavirus, because this is what all coronaviruses do. So working on the assumption that the thing is not going to go away, the reason people have to do what they want to do is to protect themselves. Most Brits have protected themselves. So they can still catch it, they can still pass it on, but they have protected themselves from severe illness, clogging up hospitals, and of dying. This is the argument for opening up the economy, saying now it's up to you. This has gotten to the stage where it just is about self-interest and do what you find to be in your best self-interest. The pushback coming from the BBC, amongst others, has basically been anti-vax. They say vaccines don't work. The people are not protected. Only lockdowns can save us. You need to keep them up for the next, indefinitely. And that might sound like an exaggeration, but I listen to BBC4 every morning, and they have been pushing out more information to discredit the usefulness of vaccines on the pretense that the only reason a vaccine would ever be good is because it saves other people's lives. So they keep saying the only thing these things are good for is they save other people, but now they don't save other people, so we need lockdown. They are pushing more disinformation than my sort of country bumpkin friends in the heartland, who thought that the way to beat coronavirus was with cream soda and cane spirit. I think it's very disappointing. I think it won't last until you tried it,
Gabriel.
Yeah, I know. So maybe I sound like a bit of an elitist, but I think that putting liberty first, letting people choose how do you want to do things, how do you want to live your life at this stage, is a perfectly reasonable thing to do. And I will just note as a final point that it was the UK who really set the tone for most of the rest of the world in terms of lockdowns. And it might be them that sets the tone for the rest of the world in terms of open-ups. And South Africa is in a bizarre situation where, although we're not very vaccinated, it seems like we turn out to have as many vaccines as people want, excepting for people my age, though I'd like it. I can't get it. Everyone else seems to be able to have that choice. And most people say no. And our case numbers are high, but our deaths are relatively low outside of Gauteng. So the rest of the country should probably follow suit and open up. But that's a story for another day.
Yeah, indeed.
Anyway, as often is, decentralizing, giving people freedom, these are things that do a lot of good. And then well done to Johnson for doing that. Anyway, that's all the time we have for today. We are going over time now, so thank you very much for listening. Please like, subscribe, comment, review, all those good things. And I don't say it enough, go to thedailyfriend.co.za if you aren't coming from there already. It's got news, analysis, lots of good stuff. We've got a cartoon section, all sorts of things like that. And other podcasts, check it out, read us. I think you will enjoy us if you don't already. Anyway, thank you very much and have a wonderful week. See you tomorrow.